Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So it's the one pra observance night, new moon, and also Saturday night, and close to the winter solstice, just maybe a day or two from now. I'm not sure exactly when it is, but it's pretty close, the shortest day of the year. And opportunity to come together, monastic community and lay community, to practice, share reflections and Dhamma conversation. Take the precepts and reflect on the goodness in our lives from having stumbled upon the Dhamma practice, the teachings, and finding good people to share that with. Really taking a moment to let that sink in and feel a sense of gratitude for having this in our lives. I generally scan the headlines in the news fairly regularly, pretty much every day. Not so much to really get into the news and read a whole lot, but just to see what's happening in the world, mostly on a headline basis. And every now and then I'll read something a little bit more in depth if it's something that's real significant. And I think probably most of you who check in on the news every now and then may have followed at least some of the happenings last week. I think it was last week, with the release of the Senate report on what's euphemistically called enhanced interrogation that went on in the aftermath of 9/11. And it's interesting because I haven't seen much in the news headlines at all about the past few days. It's like it took on a big, significant chunk of attention for a few days, and then all of a sudden, absolutely nothing that I've seen, at least in the headlines. I'm sure there's places you could dig to find more analysis of it, but it's rapidly disappeared from the Google headlines anyway. But just reflecting on sort of what it is that can happen in the world, you know, what the human birth is capable of for at all of its extremes, from the very bottom to the very top. And I guess I have to say that my sense of this whole thing was that was pretty close to the bottom, if not all the way, about the things that happened during that time. The fact that it's even debatable whether it was a questionable activity or not, you know, is pretty much amazing to me. And you know, hearing the report and the testimonies and the rebuttals against the people, some of the people anyway, who were involved, and the capacity that some people had to, you know, pretty much defend it still, not only then when it was happening, but even now, many years later, when it was so clear, you know, of the just the immensity of the harm that was done, to still defend it, and to even using the argument, you know, there's the whole debate about whether it actually was effective or not, and you know, obviously I think the reports deemed that it was probably pretty clearly ineffective and definitely even counterproductive to their goals of getting more information. But to even use that as an argument, you know, even to consider the fact that maybe doing some of those kinds of things was could be justifiable if it gave the results that it was intended to, just to even bring that into the argument is kind of another layer of, yeah, in a way, deceit. A way of deceiving ourselves that level of harmfulness could ever be justified. So I reflected on that a fair amount on those few days that I was reading about it. I was also reminded, because Thich Nhat Hanh is in the news these days, I think he's still alive. A few weeks ago, it seemed like he was fairly close to passing away, but as far as I know, he's still with us. But I remember one of the first things I read in Buddhist teachings was a poem that he wrote a long time ago. And I don't remember it very well, but I remember the name of it was Call Me By My True Names. Some of you may be familiar with that one. And it was a poem that more or less recounted the truth, I think, that any of us is capable of just about anything. He talks about, you know, really when we look at it inside ourselves, you know, we're not only the victim, but we're the perpetrator. We're the one who's been killed, and we are the murderer. That, you know, we are the prey and we are the predator. You know, my interpretation of it, or the reflection I had at the time, was all the many lifetimes we've had, the uncountable number of lifetimes we've had this experience of being just about everywhere along the gradation of sentient life. And to feel separate or superior or apart from other beings, to judge them without reflecting on the fact that we too have probably been there, is a mistake. It's not to justify any kind of unskillful actions or harmful actions in any way whatsoever, but to acknowledge that it's within the capacity of all of us to go there if we lose the plot. Greed, hatred, delusion are at the base of our existence. I don't have to go back too many lifetimes to see the inclinations, even in my own life, before I came across Buddhist thought, precepts, that kind of thing, that, you know, in perhaps smaller ways, can see the inclinations, you know, still in the potentials in my own heart. And until we're firmly established in the teachings, until we've entered the stream, we have the capacity to backtrack. The forces are very strong. And the effort needed to maintain clarity and sensitivity are great. But, you know, without a kind of a moral structure, it is easy to get mixed up, get deluded, and act on some of our more unwholesome instincts. Yeah, I can even, you know, remember as a teenager doing things like, you know, killing animals, small animals, insects, things like that, or as a kid doing that, and going fishing. And it wasn't until really many, many years later, looking back on it, that I realized that I just wasn't aware, I just wasn't cognizing, you know, that when you put a hook into a little fish's mouth, that it actually hurts. Or when you take it out, you know, or when they're flopping on the deck, that means they're struggling to breathe in their own way out of the water. It just wasn't something that crossed my mind. Or all the little things that kids do, you know, with insects and whatnot. So it is a potential that we all have inside of us. And we have to take care to nurture respect, kindness, sensitivity. One of the qualities that the Buddha talks about as part and parcel of this process is what he calls hiri otapa, hiri and otapa, two very similar qualities, slightly different in some ways. But hiri sometimes being translated as shame, but that has a pretty strong connotation in Western thought, moves along the lines of guilt. Another translation that's maybe not so grammatically correct, but more, I think, the spirit of it is conscience. Otapa, often translated as something like fear of wrongdoing or concern for not doing wrong. So these two combinations, or these two qualities, conscience and concern, are what the Buddha calls the Lokapala, or the guardians of the world. They are the qualities that we can nurture inside of ourselves and reflect on as a way of protecting goodness in the world. The quality of hiri is a quality that, as we establish it, will help us to keep from moving along these lines that can be so easy to get into, starting in little ways and moving on to bigger ways. Because if we do something that's harmful to ourselves or to other people, we have this capacity to reflect on it, to remember it, and to bring it into consciousness, and to explore it and examine it, see what it feels like. And when we feel the sense of regret, then that forms a basis for future action. We can really realize that as we reflect on some unskillful action, then it feels bad. It's just natural when we cross the boundary of say, one of the precepts against harming, and we allow it in and we reflect on it and we really look at it, then there's an automatic sensitivity, a feeling inside ourselves that says, oh, that doesn't feel good. So that's that sense of hiri, conscience. And then the result of concern, otapa, would be that which gives us the sensitivity to look around us and prevent ourselves from doing it again. That concern for not wanting to cross those boundaries helps check our actions. I think Ajahn Janaka might have brought this up in a talk recently of some sort, but the Buddha's talking to Rahula about being very aware of what one's actions are, both all in body and speech and mind, and that if one is about to do something and can sense that it might cause harm, then before you do it, you check yourself and you say, no, I'm not going to do it, and see what the results of that feel like. Usually it feels good to have prevented oneself from doing that. But if you miss the opportunity to put the check on and you go ahead and do it, then while it's happening, if you can pull together a sense of mindfulness and see that you're engaged in something that's not for the benefit of others, that's going to be harmful to oneself or to others, then while you're doing it, you stop. It's never too late to stop, turn back, and then examine the effects. And if you are able to stop yourself, you also examine the effects of that. How does it feel to have stopped, caught yourself and stopped, turned around and gone back? And then if you actually complete the action, body, speech, or mind that's caused harm, then afterwards, when you recognize it, you review that. And how did that feel? And make the resolution to try and catch yourself earlier the next time. And that the more you do that and then reflect on it, and the more times you catch yourself before you act on that kind of impulse, you can see the results in the mind are actually one of delight and contentment and happiness. So it's important to reflect on not only the times that we've forgotten and lost, but the times that we have seen clearly and stepped back using these using these guardians of the world here in Ottapa. Another quality that the Buddha talks about, it's kind of a further development along those lines, is the quality of apamada, heedfulness, which is a interesting word when you think about it. It's a quality that the Buddha really encourages, and in fact, in some of his verses, talks about it being the essential part of the main quality of the path to the deathless, heedlessness or circumspection. And when I think about it, it seems like it's kind of a combination of many, many good qualities, starting with mindfulness, the ability to bring to mind and bring oneself into the moment, to recollect, to raise up in the memory qualities that have a moral effect, to use mindfulness along with clear comprehension to really see what it is that you're doing, the effects that it's having, the context in which you're doing some sort of action. And with that mindfulness and that clarity, also, and most importantly, applying it to the aspect of moral efficacy, bringing into mind, is this a wholesome action? Is this an unwholesome action? So in my mind anyway, it's a combination of these qualities of mindfulness, clear comprehension, and the sila, the morality, the context of what it is that we're doing, that all together brings this quality of circumspection and heedfulness to fruition. So it's a very advanced practice in some ways. If we can develop that quality of alertness and recollection all of the time in conjunction with the moral precepts, then we're very far along the path to ending suffering. But it takes a lot of effort to maintain that quality of mind. And, you know, in a lot of ways, many, if not most of us, I think, have some good experience with refraining from the grosser levels of harm that can be done. But the internal impulses are still very strong, and there's subtle ways that we can start to hedge the precepts as well. Ajahn Amaro used to talk a lot about it in many of his talks, the character that's within most of us called the internal lawyer, that has this ability to justify many different things, you know, and perhaps it was a very strong internal lawyer that was going on in the minds of many CIA agents back in the interrogation days there. But it's that mind that can work very hard to justify what it is that we do. This isn't a slight on lawyers. I'm sure there's a lot of good lawyers out there too. But you can just see it, you know, in that particular example, trying to, the ends justifying the means in harming other creatures. Or, say, on the level of the second precept, that precept to refrain from, and we chanted it tonight, to refrain from taking that which is not given. You know, I think most of us probably aren't bank robbers or burglars, household burglars, that kind of a thing. We're a bit more circumspect than that. But sometimes the internal lawyer can justify other things, or just not even see some of the subtler kinds of ways that we can break this precept. I remember, again, a time from maybe as a late teenager that a friend of mine helped convince me. I needed a little convincing, but not too much, but there was this old abandoned house in the neighborhood that was clearly abandoned, had been for many, many years, was, you know, broken windows and doors not on and just had deteriorating, rotting. But for some odd reason, there was still a huge amount of furniture in it that was still pretty well intact. And I was needing to furnish my apartment, and I agreed, and he convinced me to that this was all abandoned stuff, that nobody owned it anymore, obviously had been completely neglected for many, many years, and that might as well go ahead and help ourselves to it, since it was just going to rot away anyway. And there was something in me that didn't feel quite right about it, obviously, because I felt very paranoid when I was in the house looking around. But that wasn't enough of a clue for me. It was a little bit thick. And so I went ahead and helped myself to a couple of things. And it's funny, never felt comfortable about it. And even to this day, you know, almost 40 years later, it still gives this pang of pain in the heart that I was capable of doing that. Because obviously there was still an owner to the house at some point. That's the internal lawyer was very good at justifying that they had abandoned it. Or, you know, maybe there's, you know, subtler ways, you know, the whole tax system, filing income taxes, you know. This isn't really income. It's not being reported. Nobody's keeping track of it. I don't need to include that. Or maybe the certain deductions or whatever that are a little bit on, you know, was that really a business lunch or was it more of a personal lunch? Those kinds of things. Even little things like office supplies, you know, the taking office supplies home from work and using them, personal things, you know. So these are just little subtle areas that we sometimes miss. But if we're really interested in refining our practice and refining our minds, we can even take it to the extent of, you know, not using pencils from work at home, and see how the, you know, without getting real uptight or paranoid or compulsive about things, but just see how, you know, there can be danger in the slightest fault, because once the mind starts justifying little things, then the habit is there. If one's not careful, there can be a slippery slope. Relationships, whether you're, you know, maybe if you have a long-term partner, say, and a committed relationship, then, well, you know, if they don't know, just one little affair on the side, you know, that really isn't, that's not going to cause any harm. But does it really, what effect does it really have in the mind, in the heart, the secrecy, the protection, the, you know, the level of mistrust that introduces into an otherwise wholesome relationship? It's not something that one can easily just stuff away or justify. It will come back in the mind at some point in time. And then you're left with the decision of, oh, do you fess up? Do you do it? Do you admit it? Bring it to light? Because will that cause more harm? Or is it better to keep it a secret to prevent the other person from being upset? Just opens up a whole can of worms. That's why we have this precept. Precept against lying, deceiving. A very, very strong one. And one that's also can have some uncertain grounds. One can easily justify small white lies, as they're called, particularly if it's around, if saying something or having to talk about some truth causes discomfort for somebody else, then sometimes we feel like we might be able to be justified with a little white lie. It used to come up, I remember, in the medical field, the nursing, when I was in nursing school, sometimes seeing family members insist that their loved one not be told of a serious diagnosis or of a terminal diagnosis for fear that it would cause them a lot of worry, fear, concern, and better to just, you know, quote unquote, tell a little white lie and say, oh, everything will be all right. Or even, I remember learning in school not to even do that with kids when you're giving them a little injection, saying, oh, this won't hurt. Because as soon as you do it and it hurts, you'll never be trusted again. So little ways that we justify a lie, watching the effect that has. one of our teachers, Ajahn Jayasaro, I once was listening to a talk of his, and he has a very nice way of talking about it in terms of keeping precepts to a very refined level. He calls it working with concentric circles. And it's really particularly noticeable in the monastic life. We've got lots of very refined rules in our Patimokkha rules, the 227 precepts that go into a lot of detail and are very, seem like sometimes quite picky the ways that we observe these basic four moral precepts, but on a much more detailed level. And it's like you have these concentric circles of precepts, so that if you follow them very carefully, sometimes you might transgress one of the minor precepts, but that's your baselines, and it protects you from making bigger mistakes. So that really following quite diligently the precepts around non-harming, not even say raising one's hand against another human being as, you know, in a threatening gesture. That's one of our pachitya rules, just raising your hand in a threatening gesture. But that sensitivity, that level of say, keeping the precept against non-harming gives us a lot of protection from doing something that would cause much greater damage, like striking a being or, you know, killing another being of any kind, animal, human. So that these are concentric circles that protect the little ones that we keep so thoroughly, protect us from breaking the bigger ones. And the Buddha talks about different kinds of generosity, different kinds of giving, and one of them is what's called abhayadana, the gift of fearlessness. And you can see how this level of conscience, concern, heedfulness, with the way that we live our lives is really a gift. It's a gift not only to ourselves, but it's a gift to the world around us. And, you know, sometimes we think of being fearless as being very brave and doing things that are heroic along those lines. But actually the greatest gift of fearlessness is the way that we can follow these precepts in such a way that it gives a sense of safety to the world around us. We can become a center for security, safety. Other beings can come into our lives and not feel afraid. Here in the monastery, we establish this very clear sense of precepts, and people come because they feel safe. They know that other people staying here aren't going to be taking advantage of them, aren't going to be taking things that belong to us, are going to be trying their best to speak honestly and gently. So there's a sense of refuge. And even the animals in the forest, the creatures around us feel that and know that. So this abhayadana, this gift, this giving of fearlessness, of non-harming, is something that we can feel really good about. It's important to reflect on the effect of this kind of heedfulness, because it really softens the mind. It really creates a sense of goodness and spaciousness, a sense of real freedom, really, in the heart. We don't have to suffer the repercussions of the memories of harmfulness. We don't have to worry about trying to protect ourselves. That lack of anxiety, worry, fear is a great gift. And it opens the door for our being able to move in the practice into a very deep way. In fact, if we really follow it very carefully and really reflect on it and reflect on the good feeling that it brings inside, we're, you know, well along the way to establishing a state of concentration and pleasure in the mind that is really not accessible without that. We can't force that kind of peace and happiness in our minds just by sitting and watching our breath. So really taking time to reflect on the advantages of sila, and also allowing compassion to come into our awareness, to realizing that, you know, if we don't maintain the effort, if we don't have the effort to maintain these senses of compunction, of heedfulness, conscience, then we do have the capacity to succumb to some of the more base impulses that are there as part of us too, part of all of us, until we really move far along the path. And we can have the compassion to see that other people are struggling with this in sometimes quite deluded ways, but that they too have the capacity. Someday they may come to their own realization that there's a better way to do it, a way that's more peaceful, leads to contentment and happiness, and still has the effect that it needs to have, that they need to have to function in the world. They don't have to act on those confused, deluded impulses. And we can help others along the way by setting the example in our own lives. So I think I'll leave it there for this evening and call it a talk. Sadhu Karam Dhamma Se